Apologies for the poor sound quality there, but that was me improvising on a classical melody. And if you recognize it, please tell me, because I've forgotten where I heard it. You can send me a message on our Facebook page, Safe and Sound Radio Show and Podcast, and enlighten me. Welcome to Safe and Sound, New Zealand's only animal rights show. My name's Sandra Kyle, and it's my pleasure to bring you two interviews today on the theme of global warming. The first is with Dr. Brett Mullen, Principal Climate Scientist at NIWA, who will be putting us in the picture about climate change patterns in New Zealand in the last 50 years or so, as well as climate projections into the future. In the second interview, I speak with animal and environmental activist and regular Safe and Sound host, Paul Judge, who outlines for us the effects animal agriculture is having on global warming. But to start off, a young vegan friend's original composition. Emmett Sutherland-Sweet has a degree from the New Zealand School of Music and is currently doing his master's there in music therapy. He's a songwriter and performer, influenced by the Beatles, Buddy Holly, Randy Newman, Bob Dylan, Nick Drake, and Tim Hardin. He's concerned with animal sentience, ecology, and Eastern philosophy, and often thematizes these issues in his songwriting. Let's listen now to Emmett's song.
Well, I've seen her around, and I know her style. It's all I gotta do, and I'm sitting here.
About you, but my toes were tapping. Great job, Emmett. And I'd just like to mention here that if there are any other musicians out there writing their own songs about animals or the environment, I'd be happy to look at playing them on the program. Okay, let's go now to our interview with Dr. Brett Mullen. Dr. Mullen is Principal Scientist in NIWA's Climate, Atmosphere and Hazards Centre and the Group Manager of the Climate Variability Group on the Wellington campus. Brett was a member of the Royal Society of New Zealand Climate Committee until recently and has played a lead role over many years in analysing climate models and producing climate change scenarios for New Zealand. He's also worked with many end users of climate change information to explore the impacts of climate change. So, Brett, could you outline climate changes in the last, say, 50 years in New Zealand? Just give us a general idea of the chief trends.
Yes, well, we're seeing a number of changes in climate over the past decades that generally are in line with what the climate models tell us to expect for the future. So we've seen, for example, an increase in average temperatures across New Zealand by something like 1 degree in the past 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar globally as well, but in for New Zealand, if we focus on New Zealand, about 1 degree. And associated with that, there are fewer cold nights and more hot days. There's lots of variability due to weather fluctuations in some of these climate variables, so that in looking at the data, we like to say whether it's statistically significant or not, and we can say that, I think, for cold nights, but not yet for hot days. But there is a general increase in hot days as well. The other thing that's very clear is there's been an increase in sea level, so some sea level rise of about 18 centimetres around New Zealand in the last 100 years.
Has most of that taken place in the last, say, 20, 30 years?
No, I mean, it does go in a little bit, to some extent, fits and starts, because there are natural variations associated with El Niños as well, or what we call also low frequencies, slower decadal variations. So it's not just in the last 30 years, no. So over a longer period of time. The other thing that's happening in the sea is increasing acidity in the coastal waters. We can say we've seen this off Otago because we don't have very long records of acidity in the waters around New Zealand, but the longest record we have is from off the Otago coast starting in 1998, and over that period it's quite clear there's a progressive increase in or reduced alkalinity and therefore increased acidity in the waters.
So what's causing the increased acidity?
Just a pure chemical reaction with the atmosphere, increasing carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere, overlying atmosphere, exchanges, you know, an equilibrium with the ocean. So you build up the CO2 in the ocean, and that means there's more hydrogen ions. Yes, increases acidity. Back over the land, there are changes in rainfall and dry conditions. Harder to establish definitely because they're a lot more variable with time, but I think we could probably say that we're seeing increased drought in eastern areas, parts of eastern areas, like I would single out Wairarapa and Marlborough, those two most likely. Possible increase in rainfall extremes and flooding. I mean, these are just so variable, and things like flooding are subject to other things. If we're changing the flow of rivers and so forth, changing extraction of water from rivers or putting up stop banks and so forth, that can influence these things as well. We are seeing rainfall trends over the last 50 years, generally more rainfall in the west and less in the east. And that pattern of change is actually what the climate models say we should expect for the future. But whether this is really a sign that it's climate change driven or whether it's these decadal fluctuations, because we do see these long period variations in wind strengths across New Zealand and therefore rainfall. So it might be a natural effect for the moment, even if it's been happening in the same direction as we expect climate change. Mm. So some things are climate change signals and others are less clear at this point.
So human-induced climate change, which is the excess of carbon in the atmosphere, you can't say that all the changes that are happening are due to human activity. They might just be cyclical or whatever.
Some of them might be, yes. Mm. They're probably not. At least they're not very regular cycles, but they may be cyclical or what we like to call natural variability. So yes, when you come to look at impacts, it's even more complicated because there are certainly other factors affecting the environment besides climate. If you look at kiwi fruit moving out of Northland, not being so economic up there, that's very likely a climate effect.
If nothing is done, I think some of your models go out to 100 years into the future. If there's no intervention, no improvements made, and the trend continues, we'll be well above the 2 degrees. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Well, we're already at least halfway towards it, or more than halfway, because when they talk about these 2 degrees warming above, that they relate it to what's called pre-industrial, which is usually defined for convenience as late 1800s. So we've already seen more than 1 degree warming since then globally, and it's related to globally too rather than New Zealand, although the trends aren't that much different so far. So yes, so we'll be certainly well above that if things continue on what's often called a business as usual. And at NIWA, we've certainly looked at the climate model projections. We call projections into the future with a range of these scenarios. We sort of estimate how the greenhouse gases and other things might change in the future. And the scenario with the highest greenhouse gas emissions certainly shows continued warming and continued changes of all the things that we're already seeing.
So this continued warming, it is going to affect sea levels, it'll affect horticulturalists. You mentioned kiwi fruit, that they can't grow it so well in the north because it's just too warm now, is that right?
Yes, some crops need a chilling period in the winter. Kiwi fruit is one of those. You can mitigate that a little bit if you use chemicals. Although not all customers like that, and you might be able to mitigate it with a change in cultivar, so there's research into that. But the easiest way is to move south to cooler locations. There are ways around it, and it doesn't mean agriculture will be less economic. You just might be doing different things. But the increases that we see have other consequences. We expect a growth in pests and plant diseases. So by pests, I don't mean possums so much, but the large pests.
Insects.
I mean the small ones like insects. Along with that, we get changes in agricultural patterns, depending on which crops are most suitable in different parts. We'll see vulnerable ecosystems can be damaged as a consequence of these changes, and plants or animals no longer having the optimum habitat for where they currently live and not being able to move. So that has an influence. Other things affecting the environment are risk of erosion is likely to increase because of the higher rainfalls that we expect in the future. The risk of forest fires are likely to increase because of longer dry periods and also generally higher temperatures and higher winds at times.
People were predicting this 20 years ago, weren't they?
Oh, they were, yes, yes, indeed. The other thing that we've talked about sea level rise, so pressure on housing and the use of the coasts, low-lying areas that are almost bound to be affected. And sea level rise is something that just accumulates over a very, very long time. Even if we can stabilise the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and stop the temperatures increasing by the end of the century, I don't think anyone thinks the sea level rise will stop anytime soon. That's expected to keep going for hundreds of years. So that's an ongoing one.
Leaving government policy aside for a moment, what do you suggest that individuals can do to help decarbonise the atmosphere? You've mentioned that it may not just be human-induced climate change that's happening, but a percentage is, isn't it?
Oh, a percentage, I think, is, yes. And that's a key research endeavour at the moment, to try and work out what fraction of the change we can actually say is human-induced. So people are certainly working on that problem. So, well, what can an individual do? I mean, my own feeling is that as an individual, what you do personally is going to achieve very little unless you can convince a lot of other people to do the same, to change their behaviour too. And even with that, I think there needs to be some avenue, some mechanism available to assist you in reducing your carbon footprint. I think the only way to get there is for big business and the government to come on board. And how do you achieve that as an individual? Well, you have to, I guess, lobby individuals in those organisations, encourage them to follow that course. I don't see really much other option.
Still, it's better to, as an individual, to try and
decrease your footprint, yes. But, for example, if I want to drive an electric car instead of a car that burns fossil fuel, they have to be available for me to buy at a reasonable price. And there has to be some way of recharging the car that also doesn't burn fossil fuel. So that's a huge change in infrastructure, and I can't do that by myself.
Golly, we've allotted such a short time. It would be lovely to have you back on at another stage, Brett, and talk in a little bit more detail. But I do appreciate your coming onto the show today, and thank you for all that information. And we'll talk again.
Okay, Sandra. Nice talking to you.
Thank you, Brett. Bye-bye.
So just to sum up, climate models show that with ongoing greenhouse emissions, there will be continued global warming leading to changes in agricultural patterns. There will be more pests, more erosion, more forest fires, and sea levels will continue to rise. Just this week, there have been a couple of stories about climate change effects. One of them was about a native spider. It's called the trapdoor spider because it springs out of its concealed burrow to catch its prey. The spider is threatened because of changing rainfall patterns, and these little buddies are vital to their ecosystem, controlling insect populations, providing food for birds, and so on. The other story was that sheet ice levels in Antarctica are at their lowest level ever as a result of warming sea. So we have to remember that there are many, many factors that will result out of even small changes in warming. Dr. Mullen made the point rightly, I think, that really government and big business need to be instigating changes. But I can think of one way, and I think you know what I'm going to say, that individuals can greatly reduce their carbon footprint, and that's by going vegan. I personally cannot shake the feeling that we're doing too little too late, that global warming is an emergency and needs a global, coordinated, practical response on behalf of the planet and all its inhabitants, human and non-human. And kudos to Sarah Thompson, the young law student who is now suing the government for not doing enough about global warming. Now we come to our second short interview today with Paul Judge. Paul was published recently in an international journal in response to the UN call for sustainability in education. And Paul's going to outline for us the effects of animal agriculture on global warming. Paul, I know that you're a vegan not only for your deeply felt views about killing and eating other animals, but also because of the effects that animal agriculture is having on the environment in terms of global warming, availability of water and so on. Can you just give a snapshot for our listeners of what these effects are, please?
Well, it's interesting, the figures that were published by the New Zealand government themselves in a booklet just prior to the Paris Climate Accord talks back in 2015, the government set up a number of talks, you know, seminars around the country to outline the policy. And they published in this booklet that there were the greenhouse gases that come from agriculture in New Zealand are 48%. That's 48% greenhouse gases from agriculture. Now, they consist of 17% nitrous oxide, which is, you know, comes from nitrogen and it just evaporates into the atmosphere. That's nitrogen from the animal's urine and so on. And then methane, 35%, that comes from the ruminant animals who are burping and so on from, you know, the stomachs. And CO2 as well, which makes up a part of that. From the industrial aspects of farming itself, you know, the use of tractors and transport and so on. But that's a huge amount. That equates to the world figures of around about 50-52% greenhouse gases come from animal agriculture. There are so many other aspects of the problem, of course, with animal farming on the scale that we have it in the world at the moment. And one of those is deforestation. You know, 1 to 2 acres every second cleared for animal farming. 91% of deforested land is for animal agriculture, but and that includes, of course, the not just the farmland for the animals, but the growing of grain foods and things for them as well. You know, like, for example, I think that even the palm oil industry only uses 26 million acres only. I should clarify that. 26 million acres of land has been cleared for palm oil, whereas 136 million acres has been cleared for animal agriculture. And this is, of course, we're talking about the figures since in the last sort of 40 years or so, since the great, what we call the great acceleration of human and animal biomass. Now, that's another aspect. Apart from water use, deforestation, species extinction from all that deforestation and pollution and so on, which is the figures around species extinction are horrific. But there's the actual figures of the biomass are just mind-blowing. When we talk about biomass, we're talking about the actual millions of tons of, you know, of animal and human bodies, I suppose, on the planet. Now, back the studies, you know, have shown that they estimate that back about 10,000 BC, it was, let me tell you, I've got the figures here, 220 million tonnes of biomass, with 99% of that being wild animals, 1% of that being humans. That was 10,000 BC. What have we got in 2015 AD, the recent study? 1,900 million tonnes. That's 1.9 billion tonnes. Of that's including humans and farmed animals. 91% of world biomass is humans and farm and their farmed animals, which leaves 8 or 9% for wild animals. Of course, the planet can't sustain that. So, what can we do about it? We can stop eating animals. We can do what the most thing we can do, the most important thing we can do, is stop eating animals. Stop buying into the corporate food industry that's driving this. It's such an accepted part of the culture, the farm animal industry, the exploitation animal industry. My advice is, you know, the only way we're ever going to survive, and the United Nations has released reports on this, you know, 2010, a major report advising the world to change its dietary habits. And we can make small changes gradually, but we need to do it fairly quickly en masse.
Well, that just about brings us to the end of today's show. If you want to know more about how animal agriculture is affecting global warming and the environment, then go to cowspiracy.com for more facts. They've got a lovely documentary there and also some infographics and so on. So we'll go out on a message borne by Melissa Everidge, who wrote it for the environmental documentary An Inconvenient Truth. I have been asleep, but I need to wake up. Bye, everyone. See you next week.
Have I been sleeping? I've been so still, afraid of crumbling. Have I been careless, dismissing all the distant rumblings? Take me where I am supposed to be, to comprehend the things that I can't see. 'Cause I need to move, I need to wake up, and as a child, I danced like it was 1999. My dreams were wild. The promise of this new world would be mine.